Welcome everyone to the very first episode of the Left Behind podcast for January 15th, 2020. I'm your host, Chris Markovich. On today's show, we'll be talking about the BC Eco-Socialists, a new political party that's making waves in BC politics. I speak with party board members Jeff Berner and Stuart Parker about the BC Eco-Socialists' party messaging, their party slogan, as well as their political fortunes leading into the next general election in 2021. We also get insight from several political commentators on the BC Eco-Socialists' political fortunes, as well as their electoral messaging and their strategies going into the next election as a left-wing fringe party. But first, right off the bat, right off the hop, I want to talk to you guys about how excited I am to do this podcast. It's been a dream of mine for over 2 years now, and it's only something I've really come to realize in the past couple of months. As some of you may already know, I've gone through a number of changes in my life, and I believe anyway that 2020 is going to be an awesome year for me, for the people around me, and hopefully for you guys as well listening to this show. I'm excited to talk about politics. I'm excited to talk about socialism. I'm excited to talk about social justice. And starting with this episode, we're going to talk about a lot of different things that are important to me and things that are important, I believe, to British Columbians and to Canadians. I really hope that you guys enjoy the content on this show. And if you want to support the podcast, you can do so via our Patreon page or by donating on PayPal. And most importantly, I hope that you stick around. If nothing else, I promise to entertain you guys. So with that in mind, let's get right to it, shall we?
What if we acted like everyone, every person, really mattered? Mattered as much as Jimmy Pattison. What if we just did the right thing for a change, didn't throw people or nature under the bus? And as for the money to pay for doing the right thing, what if we just took away the wealth of obscenely rich people like Jimmy Pattison and Chip Wilson from Lululemon and the people whose boys go to St. George's? What if we took their wealth away to pay for doing the right thing like we used to?
There's a new political party in town. They call themselves the BC Eco-Socialists. According to their party slogan, they're further left than the NDP, and they're greener than the Greens. But what exactly does that mean? And does it give them a chance in BC politics? That clip that you heard earlier was from one of the party's founding members, Jeff Berner. I had the opportunity to ask him that question, along with a few others, and get some insights into the party's political future. Joining me now on the show is BC Eco-Socialist Party board member Jeff Berner. He's a well-known radical left-wing Jewish singer, songwriter, accordionist, novelist, and political activist. He was born in Vancouver and has lived there all his life. He ran for the Greens in both provincial and federal elections. In Vancouver civic politics, he works to support COPE, the Committee of Progressive Electors, and in particular, he supported the campaign of City Councillor Gene Swanson. Jeff, thank you for being on the show with us.
Hiya.
So I wanted to ask you first about your political activism and what made you decide to form a new political party in British Columbia.
Well, it's just the frustration of watching this party, this government, the left-green coalition of the NDP and the Greens. When they got elected, we were ecstatic, me and my pals, because we thought, great, the NDP will bring in a bunch of great left-wing stuff, and the Greens will keep them honest on the environmental front, you know, and that'll be the best government we could possibly have, we thought. And then they turned around and they basically kept Christy Clark's government's priorities in place. They really haven't fixed anything structural or serious. They turned around and betrayed everyone who voted for them, thinking they told everyone they were canceling Site C and the LNG project when they were running, that was what they were running on. And then they turned around and approved it. They're putting billions of dollars into fossil fuel subsidies So while humanity is facing this existential threat that I've been trying to fight since the 80s, you know, and they're still piling it on. It's amazing. And the Greens really disappointed us by propping all of this up and saying, we brought in some regulations on fish farms that you might like. So that's what we've done. We couldn't do much. And it's like, yes, you could. You could have brought the government down over an existential threat to humanity and all the other stuff. Homelessness is on the rise. They've done nothing to address the childcare crisis. They're building new roads and highways instead of trains and stuff. They're totally in bed with the developers in Vancouver and Victoria, the signal was when John Horgan appointed Jeff Meggs, the developer's friend, vision counselor in Vancouver, the architect of Vancouver's disastrous gentrification policy, pro-gentrification policy that we still have. He appointed Jeff Meggs as his chief of staff. It was like a joke. You know, it was so frustrating that we just didn't know what to do at first. But now it's like, look, we have people thought they were voting for an eco-socialist government in the last election, and they didn't get it. So we have to, that's what we want. So finally, we just got our shit together and registered the party and got the website going, because it's just ridiculous at this point. We're facing extinction as a species, and these people are running a Christy Clark government. I can't even believe it.
So I'm glad that you brought up the issue of bringing the government down, because we heard a lot from the former leader of the BC Green Party, Andrew Weaver, that he was going to bring the government down on LNG. He was going to bring the government down on fossil fuels and fracking and other environmental issues, including Site C as well. What do you feel would have happened had the BC Greens followed through on their promise to bring the government down? Do you think that after the confidence and supply agreement that the NDP and Greens signed, having an election so soon after would have produced either an NDP majority or a BC Liberal majority? And would that have made the current situation better or worse than it is now?
Well, I don't pretend to be able to predict the future, but a lot of people in the Greens and the NDP do pretend to be able to predict the future. They pretend to know what would have happened if the government had been brought down. But if the Greens had provided a principled opposition to these disastrous things and said, look, you people who all voted against these things in the Kootenays, you know, the NDP MLA and the Kootenays swore up and down that they were going to cancel Site C and LNG. And we have her on videotape. That MLA could easily have been defeated by a Green candidate who stood on principle with the party that brought the government down over this issue, this promise, you know. And there are many other instances in Vancouver where a Green could have, I mean, we live in very unstable political times. The idea that everybody knows what's going to happen, if A happens, then B will surely happen, is ridiculous. You know, we know, we watched the Brexit party basically take control of Britain in a matter of months. You know, that's what's happened in the UK. We watched Bernie Sanders likely to gain the Democratic nomination against all of the conventional political wisdom. So this idea that while the Liberals were in total disarray, that if the Greens had actually stood on principle, stood for something, shown people that politicians actually are capable of having principles, the idea that that would have led to a Liberal government or an NDP majority, it's like, how do you know that? You don't know shit. And you should have just done the right thing and then figured out how to handle that politically. That's the thing, is these people put the cart before the horse. They go, oh, well, let's figure out what the old 90s laminated political playbook says is going to happen, and then figure out from there what we ought to do, instead of figuring out what the right thing to do might be and then figuring out how to sell that politically. They're doing it all ass backwards.
Now, speaking of doing things the same way since the laminated policies of the 90s, quote-unquote, I took a look at my riding provincially, as well as your riding of Vancouver Kingsway, and it looks as though most of the party elections in both of those ridings have been the same for the last 30 to 40 years. My riding in particular has had an NDP MLA since 1979, and your riding has had an NDP MLA since 1991, notwithstanding, of course, the 2001 election where the NDP was wiped out across the province. So how do you counter that? How do you get voters on your side and to vote for your party and to counter the narrative that there are safe seats in British Columbia politics?
Well, we're living in a new political era. Let's, you know, we have to be realistic about that. If we went back and told people in 1999 that Donald Trump was the president, that Arnold Schwarzenegger got elected governor of California, the latitude for change right now is huge. And these people just don't see it. For example, in the UK, all these seats in the north that were the red wall fell to the Tories because the Labour couldn't give them a clear message about what they were going to do. And they and a lot of their old supporters stayed home. That's one example. So the idea that there are safe seats and that everybody knows how things are going to go from riding to riding is also absurd at this point. And the idea that Adrian Dix, a guy who managed to blow such a huge lead as leader of the NDP, that the province printed a headline saying this man could kick a dog in the legislature and still be elected premier. He managed to blow that big a lead. The idea that he couldn't be taken out at the riding level, it's absurd. He certainly can. He's capable of blowing much bigger leads and much bigger stakes than that. So I just think it's the we're in a new era of politics. We have to acknowledge that, you know, the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her decapitation of the centrist Democrat who thought he owned that riding is a great example, you know, but we can't do that here in BC. The NDP is so centrally controlled that it's not possible to decapitate a sitting MLA and get a more radical candidate in. They would just cancel that if we tried to do that. So we have no choice but to form a new party. And the thing is, these people run their political strategy based on the fact that they are seeking power, not that they're trying to make good ideas happen. And so if we were able to get, I don't know what the margin of victory here in Vancouver Kingsway was, but if it was, say it was like, you know, 10, 15%, if we started getting in that territory in left-wing neighborhoods and ridings, that would put the fear of God in them. And they would start to adopt our policies. They would start to, because that's the thing, is the NDP and the Greens take environmentalists and social activists and workers' rights activists for granted. They just say, well, you have to vote for us. Otherwise, it's back to the Christy Clark days. So you have no choice. But really, people are just staying home. And that's what we think is going to happen in the next provincial election, is that the NDP and the Greens are going to look to their army of volunteers who they used to use to get themselves elected, and nobody is going to show up. Nobody is going to come out and knock on doors for them. Nobody is going to come out and pamphlet for them. They're going to be left with a bare-bones skeleton crew of whoever they can pay to push these things and explain these unprincipled betrayals on the doorstep. Because who is going to do that for free, for fun? Go and say, yeah, well, I know we said we weren't going to do Site C. I know we said we were going to bring in proper daycare. I know we said we were going to do, we didn't. You got to understand, it's either us or Christy Clark again. That's the message they're going to run on, and they're going to find they don't have any foot soldiers for that. So, and then they're going to start to triangulate in our direction for a change. That's what the way we see it.
So now let's pivot then to your strategy for the coming election. How are you going to A, recruit candidates, and B, give them something positive to take to the doorstep rather than employing one of those, as you had put it before, triangulation strategies of attacking the other party and saying, oh, at least we're not like them. And what policy planks are you going to run on?
Well, the main thing is that people know what eco-socialism is. It's a worldwide movement. It's about opposition to austerity, but where we don't just say, gosh, we're such a poor province that again and again, education has to suck more and like healthcare has to kind of just be a little more frayed around the edges. So we know what opposition to austerity is. We know what a Green New Deal entails, where it's like we put people to work building the infrastructure we need for the changeover from this awful fossil fuels thing that's killing everything to renewables. We know people know what eco-socialism is. We hardly have to explain it at all. And what we're going to do is we're going to provide an infrastructure for people who are already active in lots of different ways, lots of different communities, trying to preserve their watershed from being logged so they can drink clean water, for God's sake. The people, the teachers union, who find themselves in another battle with a government that wants to do illegal shit, that's going to go to the Supreme Court again saying, why can't we set what the class sizes are without having to negotiate with the teachers? Well, the Supreme Court told Christy Clark twice you couldn't do that. You know, like all this crazy stuff. We are just going to provide an electoral infrastructure for all these people, for the 120,000 people who are marching in the streets of Vancouver saying, we want something done about this global catastrophe. And you've got John Horgan saying, I love those kids. Those kids are wonderful. Well, he's actively screwing them over, you know, and we all know it. He's a liar, you know. And he's so avuncular about it. Oh, it's enraging. But anyway, we're going to provide an infrastructure. We're going to make the tools that all these people, from like the folks who are striking hotel workers and or the folks who are worrying about what kind of economic development there's going to be in their area if the mill shuts down, you know. Why can't they have some control over the land use instead of just letting a corporation decide how it goes? Oh, there's all kinds of people who are active, you know, indigenous activists all over the province are saying, okay, you've signed this United Nations thing, but you're still not actually actively consulting us over development anywhere in the province, really. We're gonna say, look, here are the tools. Here are the weapons. We're going to set up regional associations. We're actively doing that now so that we have like one area that's an active riding that's paired with a nearby riding that maybe doesn't have as many members, so that people can work together in a region. So these regional associations will actively see candidates, but also like you're going to see us at other people's rallies and other people's events and other people's strikes. And we're going to show up for people and say, we're part of this. We believe in what you're doing. And then we're going to seek out candidates from that world, from the people who already know everything's being done wrong. That's the idea, is we're going to provide this infrastructure, and especially for young people. Like, I'm a Gen Xer, and I went through all this crap as we turned the Green Party into a viable political party in the 90s, and had it taken from us by some baby boomers. But we know how to make a party and make it function, and then we're going to hand these tools over to these people who are our friends, like we've known for decades, some of them, and the young people who have joined recently, who are fighting this fight, this worldwide fight against neoliberalism and fossil fuel annihilation. So that's the plan. That's how we're going to do it. We're not going to say everybody's got to join the BC Eco-Socialists and stop what they're doing, Stop what they're doing as tenants' rights advocates and join the BC eco-socialists. No, we're going to go, okay, in this riding, we're going to run somebody from the tenants' union because they understand, they've read our housing policy. They know we wrote the housing policy based on all the stuff they say about what housing policy should be. And then they can be part of that for the election. But we're not trying to, like, we're trying to make an electoral arm of the movement. We're not trying to, like, be somebody's be all and end all.
Yeah, I think what you say makes a lot of sense now that you've said that you want folks that are candidates to have their own associations and bring those ideas to the table as candidates because your platform has those planks already in place. Now, I've looked at your platform and on your FAQ section in particular of your website, and right away one of the things that stood out to me was this question of vote splitting. And I know this is a topic that gets kicked around again and again and again, but it is a relevant question to ask, and it is a relevant issue to talk about, because a lot of voters don't see political parties in British Columbia as being either left-wing or green, but they see themselves as left-wing and or green. And yet they go to the more established parties because they feel they have no other choice. Now, I know we touched on this discussion already before, but how are you going to get folks that park their votes with, say, the BCNDP or the BC Greens and say to them that this is your home now?
Well, we have to earn people's respect. We have to show up. Like I said, we have to be showing up for people when they're doing their other civic activism, when they're doing the stuff to try to make the world a better place. They're going to start noticing that we're the ones who are retweeting their message, who are amplifying their message. We're the ones who are sending people down to their protests to beef up the numbers. And that the government, whether the Green part of the government or the NDP part of the government, isn't down there. Or if they do show up, they're not able to answer questions about why they're not doing the right thing. So that's one of the things. But in terms of the vote splitting argument, you really have to see what the right has done so successfully is they articulate what they want and they pound away at it and they drag their mainstream counterparts on the right in towards them until they don't even have to run. Again, look at the UK. What you see in the UK election is the Nigel Farageization of the UK. Everything he wanted to have happen in the UK is happening. So he didn't even have to run candidates in most of the Tory ridings. He didn't feel the need because he knew Johnson was going to do exactly what he wanted. And so look what the right does and how successful they are. It's simply articulating what it is they want and not tolerating anybody who's going to soft pedal it. And we should be doing that on the left. We should be articulating the world we wish to live in. And if people aren't ready quite yet to embrace us at the beginning because they question our legitimacy and stuff like that, that's totally understandable. We have to earn people's respect. We have to earn their vote and their support. But the idea that they're going to make bad people be in government because they supported us, it's just not true. I mean, what's going to happen is as the tea leaf readers of the NDP and the Greens notice our presence start to expand, once we start appearing in opinion polls and stuff like that and in the press, they're going to go, oh, geez, we've got to protect our left flank. Maybe we should do something. So the more people who come to us, the more the other parties are all going to be dragged in our direction. And so that's the argument we make against the vote splitting thing is that we can't just surrender all the time to basically the policies that the NDP and the Greens are pursuing are 1980s Tory policies. They're George Bush senior policies. That's unacceptable because we're all going to die. It's that simple. It's infuriating watching this happen. And the idea that we just have to sit there and take it and let them manage our demise is ludicrous at this point.
Now, one final thing I'll ask you, in terms of what we should be doing in BC. Looking ahead to the next provincial campaign, what is going to be the BC Eco-Socialist strategy to get as many candidates as they can into the field and running under the BC Eco-Socialist flag? Because some of the smaller parties have historically been unable to run enough candidates to even make a splash in a general election. So how are you going to get more candidates out and get more people to sign up to the party as well?
Well, I mean, that's a pretty huge question. It's a process where, like I said before, we're setting up regional associations where we find a hotspot where we've got a fairly decent number of people in a riding, and then we partner them with the next door riding that's not doing as good, and that becomes an organization in and of itself, so that even if the riding next door can't manage to find a candidate and a financial agent, well, we can organize that from next door. And then once we're organizing that from next door, then maybe we can expand further, you know. And of course, you know, a big part of what we can do now is using the internet, and using Facebook advertising is regionally targeted. So we're able to actually go, okay, we're going to put some ads in Terrace and see who we can get by putting out our message in Terrace, or you know, and that kind of thing is a way that you do it. But a lot of it is reaching out again to the activist organizations all over the province and saying, we support you. Like, what can we do to amplify your message? What can we do to give you the help that we can give you as a provincial organization, you know? And then by forging these alliances and not trying to absorb them into our organization, that's a big mistake I think that left-wing parties often make, is like, oh, we're going to be the game now. You come and be part of us. Don't worry anymore. You could be part of this thing. That's not what we're going to do. We're going to reach out to the folks opposing, other folks opposing Site C, and to the anti-poverty activists throughout the province. And we're going to be like, how can we amplify your message? How can we help you do what you're doing? What can we lend you of the things that we've accrued that would help you do your thing? And in this way, it spreads. But you have to actually earn it. You have to be doing things for people, be showing up for people in order to show them that you're not just there to use them at election time and forget. And because that's something the NDP really was guilty of. Like, they were very hooked into the anti-poverty and activist world when the Socreds had control for so long in the 80s. And when they finally got in, it famously, you know, Jean Swanson had End Legislative Poverty. She used to have a Christmas party every year. And then when they got in, they weren't at the party anymore. So, like, we gotta make sure that people feel like they know us. They're dealing with people. They're not dealing with the BC Eco-Socialists. It's more like they have somebody in their organization who's intrigued enough to have joined, and they're dealing with Mary, you know? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's how we have to do it.
Jeff Berner has played countless rallies, benefits, and picket lines for various social justice and environmental causes, including Stop Trans Mountain, the Downtown Eastside SRO Collaborative, as well as opening for Noam Chomsky in front of tens of thousands of people at the rally against the Iraq War on Sunset Beach in 2004. You can find him on Twitter at Jeff Berner, as well as on his personal musician website, jeffberner.com. You can also follow the BC Eco-Socialists on Twitter at BC Eco-Socialist, as well as on their website, bcecosocialist.ca. Thank you so much, Jeff, for joining us on the show today, and I wish you all the best in 2020.
Thanks a lot. Take care, Chris.
Coming up next, I speak with Stuart Parker, former BC Green Party leader and founder of the Los Altos Institute, a left-wing think tank. Joining me now on the show is Stuart Parker, one of the directors of the BC Eco-Socialist Party. He hosts a radio show in Prince George on CFIS, known as After 9, on 93.1 FM in Prince George on Monday mornings. He has been a university lecturer, a full-time research scholar, paid consultant for the NDP, the leader of the BC Green Party, an insurance adjuster, and a telemarketer for a carpet cleaning company. It sounds like you've led quite the life already. So why don't you give us a little bit of background in your political life and what you're doing now?
Well, I think that I had an interesting conversation with Bill Tillman during the last provincial referendum. I was on the yes side. He was on the no side. We had a lot of very good talks. And one of the things that Bill said is, he said, I usually hate people who switch parties, but I don't mind you at all because you stay exactly the same. It's the parties that change. And I think that's a reasonable assessment of my politics. The planet's atmosphere and climate have been front and center in my politics since I was 15 years old. Questions of human equality and redistribution of wealth have been front and center. And as the ideas that I have become more or less mainstream, I've had a series of different political homes. But I have always asserted that rapid and dramatic change has to be made to our economy, to its very structure, to address the extinction event that we're heading into. And it's unfortunate that so many of the predictions that many of us made in the late 1980s are now coming true 30 years later. Obviously, you know, I was a member of the New Democratic Party for 17 years, the last time I was a member. I was a paid worker for the party. I sat on various committees. I also negotiated the first NDP Green agreements back in 1999 with Glenn Clark. So I celebrated when our government was elected. I thought that the priorities of people like me would be the priorities of the government. And instead, this NDP Green coalition has turned into a counterfeit. I mean that in the medieval sense of the word, as in it's how Lucifer would have mocked a socialist Green coalition, right? The Green Party tells us that their big achievements that they're proud of are the Clean BC plan, which has no emissions cuts and no enforceable components until 2050, and also calls for doubling the number of logging trucks and mining vehicles in our province. The Greens are also proud that they were able to hold the line and prevent the minimum wage from rising to $15 an hour right away. They're very proud of that. And they're proud that they have brought Uber to British Columbia, bringing its poverty, records of sexual assault, and of course, massive congestion and emissions increases. The NDP, on the other hand, are proud that they've given $6 billion in government subsidies to companies like Royal Dutch Shell to build the largest carbon bomb ever built in British Columbia in the form of the Kitimat and wood fiber LNG projects. So, you know, after the shock wore off, it became evident that something had to be done to deliver British Columbians the thing they thought they were getting when Andrew Weaver and John Horgan shook hands at that press conference.
So then, when talks began about forming a new political party, did you have already in mind some folks that you wanted to speak to? Did you already have an idea as to what the party's platform and mission would look like?
There are two different things the party is trying to do. And I think both of them are worthy, and it's very fortunate that we can do both using the same organization. I did not consult widely, nor did Jeff Berner or Alana Neusmall, the original committee of three, the unfortunate triumvirate that put this together. And the simple reason was that it was perfectly clear that this thing needed to be created. It needed to come into being. And what we needed to do was to provide a space for the thousands of British Columbians who want to work for the things that we believe in, the things that the climate strikers believe in, the things that the renters unions across the province believe in. The work of creating a political party, the bureaucratic morass of regulations and auditing and political funding, is not fun. We wanted to make sure that ready to go, because this government could fall at any time, ready to go would be a space that activists and communities across the province could step into and run as candidates on their values. So obviously the nucleus of this organization strongly resembles the nucleus of the 1990s Green Party. I don't think anybody looking at who we are and what we stand for, I don't think that's lost on anybody who was around 20 years ago. It was an eco-socialist party in the 90s, and many of the people who've already become associated with it were part of that project. Megan Curzon's, Betty Krosick, lots of usual suspects. On top of that, though, we're already seeing much younger people coming into the party who fortunately didn't have to go through 1990s BC politics. So we started with a platform and an organization that's going to hold its first convention next year. We have a big policy document that the membership can accept or reject or amend or rebuild. But we wanted to give people a sense of what a government with eco-socialist principles would do. Because a lot of the time people say, well, you know, this is all very abstract. There's no way a government could do this. And so we wanted to make sure that people could see that there are concrete policy proposals that could turn things around. Now, you know, so since we launched, hundreds of people have joined the party online, even though we didn't even seek out mainstream media coverage. We're just trying to get the word out through the various networks of people who have been doing the hard work of holding this government to account, that this is yet another strategic vehicle for doing that.
So then in that vein, as far as holding the government to account, do you think that the BC Eco-Socialists are going to look to be a force in the next election, or are you looking beyond that?
Well, in the next election, so look, Andrew Weaver has held the balance of power in the legislature for over 2 years, and he didn't use it to stop Site C. He didn't use it to stop the LNG plants. He never once threatened to bring this government down. And what that means is this could have been a very different situation. Andrew Weaver could have said, you have lost the confidence of the Green Party. We will vote against you on every confidence measure unless you repeal those LNG subsidies. He's refusing to do that. But the fact is that our first thing we're trying to do is find one NDP backbencher, one Green backbencher who will join us. Because once that happens, we will hold the balance of power in this legislature, and we will have a knife to the NDP's throat. And you know what? I worked within the NDP for 17 years, sitting on committees, trying to use democratic vehicles to get things done. In the late 1990s, I was the leader of the BC Green Party, and I got all kinds of things out of the NDP. And the conclusion that I have reached, based on nothing but experience, is the only way the NDP will actually do something decent or responsible is if they have a knife to their throat. And it is our party's job to put that knife to the NDP's throat, to threaten their government with failure and dissolution. Because The whole planet's on the line. These carbon bombs that they're building here in Kitimat and Squamish are enormous. And the amount of additional fracking they will have to do to make that happen will be enormous. Never mind the gigantic hydroelectric project. So the fact is, survival is on the line. We have all these warnings that the caribou will be extinct in British Columbia, thanks to John Horgan's policies. Species are literally going extinct before our eyes, and we need to start acting like it is the desperate situation that it is. So our first work will be in getting someone to cross the floor. The next thing we will do is we will make sure that we are fielding candidates in every riding in the next provincial general election. Some of those candidates will have a shot at winning. On places like Vancouver Island, the West Kootenays, the North Coast, the Sunshine Coast. But in a riding like Caribou North, just south of me, Caribou North is one of the number one NDP target ridings in the next election that they're going to try to win to get a majority government. We will deny them that majority unless they stop this LNG insanity. I did this in 1997 in Vancouver East. I ran against the NDP and I said, but I will step down at any point and throw my support behind you if you stop these welfare cuts that are driving people into the streets and have doubled the province's homeless population. We are going to lay down the same gauntlet next time. NDP, Greens, stop this insanity. And we will join with you. We will endorse you. But if you insist on running headlong into extinction like this, we have no choice but to deny you the margin of victory in every single riding we possibly can. And I am confident that we already have sufficient popular support to do that.
So then, if you run candidates in these ridings, and let's say you threaten the NDP or the Greens or whichever party has a chance at winning that riding against the BC Liberals, for example, and they either don't cooperate or they do cooperate and the BC Liberals pick up that seat instead and then end up forming a government, what do you think is going to happen if the BC Liberals get back into power?
I think they'll do their best to continue the NDP's legacy. But look, the reality is, if the NDP has to lose power in order to screw its head on, then that's what needs to happen. There's no virtue in having a province full of Uber vehicles and automated logging trucks and no caribou and giant carbon emissions as long as it's branded an NDP environmental disaster and crime against humanity. So the issue is the Liberals are already in power. They're just called the NDP. There has been no effective change of power in this province. There has been no actual change of government. That's why the NDP kept all the senior civil servants from the Liberal Party, including those who were Fraser Institute fellows. So, yeah, there's a real risk that this government could be defeated. Now, the reality is they would have the first 16 days of the election to agree to stop this madness. Because in the first 16 days of the election, a party can withdraw its candidate. And that is precisely what we would do if we could reach an accord with the NDP and Greens to stop these subsidies to Royal Dutch Shell, the party of apartheid and the Ogoni genocide. So I think one of the mistakes that people have gotten into is saying, well, what if we split the left vote? What if one left-wing party loses because there's another left-wing party running? It's like, what left-wing party? I would challenge you to find any 1980s conservative party with policies to the right of the New Democratic Party of British Columbia and the Green Party of British Columbia. So there's this thing called progressive politics, which means running on the platform of Brian Mulroney or Bill VanderZam or Maggie Thatcher and calling that progressive.
Now, when it comes to the term progressive politics, where has that led us in terms of who believes they're actually progressive versus what the term was originally supposed to mean, and why is it still being used, even though a lot of parties say they're progressive and don't actually mean it?
Yes, well, I've dropped the term. I mean, I use it, as you can see, as a term to ridicule at this point. I think the reality is that progressivism has gone back to its original meaning, right? The founder of progressive politics, it was U.S. Republican President Teddy Roosevelt. And progressivism is the idea that social scientists and technocrats should make decisions in place of elected officials. The idea of progressivism originally was that that experts make policy and that we get regular folks out of the equation. The reason people have started using the term progressive to mean left-wing has to do with the 1960s, when all of these wealthy people from the upper middle class went into the social sciences, many people of the baby boom generation. And so social workers and people like that have always been progressive, but their ranks filled with people who were sort of vaguely left-wing or liberal. And then left-wing parties started using the term progressive because they found it was an effective way of attracting votes of this professional class. So I think that, to be progressive means thinking the experts are on your side and drawing. One of the things you see about a party like the NDP is that their candidates, the candidates they prefer to run, the people they promote within the party, are from the bureaucratic class. They're from the same class as the civil servants working in Victoria. That's why this regime has such a harmonious relationship with our provincial bureaucracy. And, you know, if you're a progressive who has this particular set of skills and connections, when the NDP isn't in power, you know, you go from being a deputy minister, maybe you'll work as a lobbyist for a while, maybe you'll do some consulting for KPMG or SNC-Lavalin, or maybe you'll become the executive director of a large nonprofit organization like Tides Canada or the Sierra Club. And what's happened is, in the 1980s, there was this major shift in the 80s and 90s of how nonprofit organizations worked. They went from being mostly democratic organizations to being mostly undemocratic organizations managed by the same managerial class that runs our governments. And that's what progressive means. Progressive refers to a class and occupation of person. And I have no problem with not being progressive. I've had an opportunity to join that class, to be an administrator, and I don't think that's where revolutionary or democratic ideas come from.
So then, where do those democratic ideas and revolutionaries come from? Do they come from the worker class and socialism and Marxism? Where do they come from?
I think that where you get revolutionary and democratic ideas is through an even older thing than Karl Marx and his ideas. But I think Marxism fits well into this larger concept. Thomas Paine, the most radical of the American revolutionaries, wrote two very important pamphlets. One was called The Age of Reason, and one was called Common Sense. Like the term progressive, common sense has changed meanings a lot since the original text. But Thomas Paine's point in Common Sense was that an educated populace could reason out loud together, could think critically together, could make democratic decisions together. And that used to be a mainstay of left politics, that if people had a basic education and critical thinking skills, they could interact with expert knowledge themselves. But what you hear today, and you hear it particularly in the climate change debate, nobody tries to explain climate change to regular folks. They just say 999 out of 1,000 scientists believe this. They make a claim to expert authority because they've stopped trusting regular folks to be able to think out loud and reason together. For us, the central aspect of our campaigning, both in terms of trying to win elections now and in trying to build a movement for the future, is the common sense tradition. It's the idea that people, that you can explain complex ideas to people. You don't have to resort to claims of expert authority, and that we as a society still have that capacity to reason together. You can see the right wing trying to undermine that in all kinds of ways through troll culture and the like. And you see progressives trying to undermine it through these appeals to expert authority and arguments all the time. But I think there's a very good place to work from. And it's not just about, I don't just believe that working folks are going to use or reach Marxist or socialist ideals. I think that regular folks reasoning out loud together has intrinsic value, that restoring that to politics has a surplus of value beyond whatever end it might be a means to.
Is that then how the BC Eco-Socialist movement is going to treat the process of getting more members and, you know, getting candidates to run for election? Are they going to use that sort of democratic process and democratic way of thinking?
We're going to try. It's tough, right? You're in a modern media environment that's even more hostile to this than it was 30 years ago when I was explaining atmospheric chemistry on TV. Increasingly, we're not betting the farm on the mainstream media. We're betting the farm on a robust culture, some of which we have to rebuild at the movement level. That's why, you know, during my first 7 years back in BC, I put all of my real energy into building my institute, because we've been testing that out on the ground, right? We do zero barrier reading groups in the Lower Mainland and Northern BC. People just pay up $25 and we're off to the races. And it's very interesting because we have different demographics in our different groups. In Vancouver, it's a lot of people who are already activists, but have found that that kind of deeper discussion has been vanishing in activist circles as everybody starts brainstorming on flow charts with facilitators who already know what the conclusions are going to be. But in Surrey, it's the people we attract are people who've had no opportunity to do post-secondary education. They're smart folks. They've never had a chance to be instructed by a university instructor. They never had a chance to read university level books, you know, and we have, you know, we've got former sex workers. We've got people doing construction day labor. We've got people in supported housing who are coming and realizing that there isn't some big trick to being an expert, that basic literacy skills and curiosity are all you need. And I think testing that out on the ground at the grassroots level has made me feel a lot more optimistic about what we might do as a party.
Tell us a little bit about Surrey First and how that municipal election went. And
oh, what insanity that was. Well, I'm very glad I didn't get back into electoral politics immediately, that I had a chance to test the waters. So we created a party in Surrey called Proudly Surrey, which was supposed to be a left-wing opposition party in the municipal election. And we tried to build a left party that would run at the school board and council level and reframe the political debate in Surrey, which is basically functions like a one-party state. There is no public square there. And it was a shocking and bizarre and painful experience. Met some great people, did some good campaigning on the ground. I got 9% of the vote. Others got 15%. A couple of people got 2%. But it was a real eye-opener in terms of the how machinations work in BC politics. BC politics has always been a bit of a hall of mirrors, a lot of illusions. The degree to which that's been amplified in the 21st century was really shocking. We put a party together with really expecting that people would be sincere about what their agenda was for being involved in the party. We ended up having entryists who were part of Narendra Modi's efforts to weaponize the Hindu diaspora. We ended up having all sorts of problems. Thank goodness the mainstream media decided to just black us out and refuse to cover us for the last month and a half. Otherwise, we might have embarrassed ourselves. But it was good getting out there and selling a left populist set of policies. That was very positive. Made a lot of good allies and friends during the process. And also you learned that you should never use an empty signifier as the name of your party. It was like, well, I guess we should put what our party's about right in the name. Because otherwise people are going to run around with your name and try and do all kinds of crazy things with it. So, it was, I would say, a sobering and salutary experience to run in a municipal election and see how, at one point, we were second in the polls. We were at 20-something percent of the popular vote because I was on Mike Smith's program and in his column all the time. But that's because Mike Smith is Rich Coleman's man, and Smith wanted to... Smith wanted somebody on the left to front this idea of creating a local police force and getting rid of the RCMP, because, of course, the RCMP really burned Coleman in the German report. You'll note that the local BC forces contributed almost nothing to that investigation into organized crime and the real estate and gambling businesses, right? It all came out of the RCMP because, of course, they're Ottawa-based. They're aligned with the Hells Angels. They don't give a damn about our little gangs out here. So Smith ended up getting to use us as a way to put forward a local police force as something that was, you know, going to be about serving people better, reducing police brutality, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly the big shift, Doug McCallum announces he's running on that platform. We're not on CKNW anymore. We're not in the province anymore. There, a blackout descends, and we've legitimated an idea that has now been twisted into massive cuts to the police budget and essentially creating a police board of criminals that Rich Coleman would approve of. So seeing that level of manipulation and corruption just in the conduct of a campaign was quite an eye-opener.
So given that you've seen and experienced some of that, as you say, manipulation at the, you know, the levels of media and government and police forces, and also given your sort of notoriety in BC politics in general, do you think that this new party, the BC Eco-Socialists, are going to encounter some sort of similar tactics from some of those players?
Oh, I think we'll encounter very different tactics. I think there's an understanding that, what the mainstream media will try to do is pretend we don't exist. They recognize that that's the worst thing that they can do is to just deplatform us, lock us out of radio debates, lock us out of televised debates. The NDP will be very effective, as they were in the 90s, at using civil society organizations to deplatform us from any all candidates meetings. So I imagine that whatever message we get out there will be either via social media or via fairly grassroots processes. I mean, I have this fantasy, of course, that some people in the legislative press gallery hate me so much that they will mistakenly start writing adversarial and negative pieces about the party. But I think they're mostly a more disciplined crew than all that. I think instead we'll just we will struggle to notify all British Columbians that we exist. And reaching out through personal networks that connect to social movements but point outwards is going to be very, very important for us. You know, and that deplatforming, right, you know, it's reached a crescendo of absurdity. It's why I think it will be what will be used on us. You know, they have all those photographs of the Democratic Party primary debates with Bernie Sanders, who's polling first, just physically cut out of the photo. Or coverage where it will never be mentioned that he attended, or what his answers to any questions were. I think that that's probably more of what we have in store. Certainly some major hatchet jobs have been written on me over the years, but I think at this point, the mainstream media is so reviled and distrusted that, you know, you're in danger of a Trump-like phenomenon if there's a media consensus to attack someone. I don't think Donald Trump could have become president of the United States if it had not been for every single newspaper in the country telling people not to vote for him. The consensus seemed so universal that people felt confident that they were punching the elite in the gut by voting for Trump. And that's why I don't think we'll see much in the way of hatchet jobs, much more in the way of silence.
Stuart Parker is the founder of the Los Altos Institute. You can find him on Twitter at Stuart Los Altos. You can also find him on his personal blog, stuartparker.ca. Thank you again for joining me on the show today, and I wish you all the best in the next election.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris.
Coming up next, what do fellow socialist political commentators think of the BC eco-socialists and their chances in the BC political landscape? I went to Christo A. Vallis and Derek O'Keefe for some answers to these questions. There's a new political party being formed in British Columbia. You may know of them, the BC Eco-Socialist Party. Do you have any thoughts on them as a political force in British Columbia, and or, you know, will they be a force in British Columbia, and what do you think their chances are?
Well, on the first two, and this is no particular remark on this party, but the history shows almost all parties fail, right? Like, that's like when Maxime Bernier formed his party and all the advantages he had, the fact that he was a former cabinet minister, came within a whisker of winning the Conservative Party leadership, had national notoriety, had been able to raise a lot of money in a short bit of time. I still said in my media reports about that. He was almost certainly set to fail, because if you look at broad Canadian history, look at the parties that exist today at the federal level that can win seats. Two of them go back to Confederation. A lot of people say, well, this new Conservative Party has no connection to the old one, but I don't really buy that. It shares a fairly strong connection to the party of the 1860s. Same thing with the Liberal Party. The Green Party is a party of any significance is less than 10 years old, basically. It's only been able to win seats since 2011, and the Bloc Québécois is younger than I am. It was born in the 90s. And so the only other party is the NDP, which has roots in the CCF in the 1930s. So put another way, there's only three major parties at the federal level in this country that are older than we are. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that goes to show that to start a political party, it's actually extremely difficult. It's actually extremely difficult, and it's probably going to fail. Now, the particular desire here of this eco-socialist party is to sort of be an alternative to both the Greens and the NDP in BC. There's a feeling that the Greens in BC are too conservative on non-environmental issues, and in some cases even on environmental issues, and that the NDP could be pushed to the left, especially on the environment, but also on on non-environmental issues, and they want to be a party of like a definitive the definitive green left. And I think there, you know, there might be an appetite for that, but the challenges exist always in, you know, the cruelty of first past the post is that, you know, a vote you take might actually hurt your cause based on the fact that, you know, it could lead to a BC Liberal victory. There's also the challenge of finding that base of support, because with first past the post, what we've seen historically in Canada is that the parties that are able to survive this cruel system are either the ones that existed from the beginning, which are the Liberals and Conservatives, or parties that were able to find some sort of niche. Because even spread support, if you're a small party, is worthless, right? That was the thing. Maxime Bernier had support in many places all over the country, but you need to clump that support. So the Bloc Québécois clumps their support. The early CCF did extremely well in Saskatchewan, did extremely well in the Prairie region broadly. Eventually, had some success in isolated mining communities, for instance, in Cape Breton, and was able to build these pockets of support. And so the BC Eco-Socialists would need to find one or two ridings where they feel they could amass enough support to get an electoral beachhead. Those ridings might be ones that are already very, very left-leaning. That could have the added benefit of, for instance, you know, not being a fear of vote splitting. Maybe there are ridings that are basically Green versus NDP contests. You might not actually split the result in any way that elects, you know, a right-wing BC Liberal. That might be something. Another alternative is that perhaps the entry point is municipal politics, because unlike in Ontario, where we do not have municipal party politics, officially at least, there are no parties at the municipal level in our provincial politics. In BC, you guys do have parties, at least in some of the communities I know. And so maybe the Eco-Socialist Party would find success running at the municipal level before running at the provincial level, and that's an alternative that doesn't really exist for small parties here in Ontario, because we don't do parties, party status or party runs at the citywide level.
So give us your thoughts on the BC Eco-Socialist Party and what you think their chances are in this BC political landscape.
Yeah, well, I actually went to observe the launch. I just show solidarity, but also just out of interest. I've kind of been an on and off NDP member. I've usually been an NDP member throughout my adult life. But like many NDP members, we've been very disappointed in a number of the big decisions, sort of the most significant for the economic development in British Columbia. Some of these decisions have been hugely disappointing since the minority government I've lost it. It's not a coalition. It is a supply and confidence agreement. Yeah, sorry, I lost the term there for a second. You know, this quasi-coalition of the NDP and Greens 2 years ago, it looked incredibly encouraging for those of us who just lived under 16 years of right-wing BC Liberal government. And the hope was that, you know, you would get the green politics of the Greens, or sort of that would push the government in a more environmental direction. And the NDP obviously would push hard and take back a lot of the things that were taken away from the labor movement, the right to unionize, get the minimum wage back up to a reasonable level, sort of catch up to other jurisdictions, since the Liberals had been imposing all kinds of, they had the training wage, you know, they refused to raise the minimum wage until the very end of their time in power. So anyway, we had all these hopes 2 years ago, and then the BC NDP comes in and they approve Site C. They do basically a reversal on LNG and end up offering billions of dollars of subsidies to expand, fracking and fossil fuel exports in northern BC and actually throughout BC. So those are two big disappointments. And then on the other hand, you had the Greens as part of the supply and confidence agreement, kind of pushing against increasing the minimum wage too quickly, against redoing the labor code to help workers unionize. And so what he basically had was the Greens were preventing the best labor and social policy from going forward. And then the NDP was sort of abandoning some of its pledges on environmental issues, including Site C and fracking, which of course are really a connected issue, that the whole reason for building Site C is connected to the expansion of gas fracking and LNG in the north. And then this gets greenwashed as, well, we're going to have the cleanest natural gas in the world because it'll be, the extraction will be powered by electricity. It's a disaster. So, given all of this over the last 2 years, I'm encouraged that a group of people sort of has the gumption and the initiative to form something new and to say, you know what? British Columbians actually wanted a green left government. That's why they didn't re-elect the Liberals. That's why some Greens got elected, but the NDP, you know, nearly had enough to form a government on its own, but it needed the Greens. And I do think if you think about the sort of movements that exist in British Columbia and that have been probably stronger here than almost anywhere else in the country, there has traditionally been a strong labor movement, a pretty strong left, although not so much in recent decades. And then also the environmental movement is huge. It's the birthplace of Greenpeace and et cetera, et cetera. So all that to say is that we do deserve an eco-socialist government here in BC. People do want the government to be more green and they want it to be more left, but somehow we've got this situation where, on the key issues, the status quo is winning out. So that's a long way of saying I'm encouraged by the development. Obviously, because proportional representation, failed, or the referendum on electoral reform failed, it's going to be very hard for any new party, to win seats. But I think, we're in a politically volatile time, and there is a strong argument to be made that the left and the green left or the eco-socialist left should have be expressing itself on its own terms under its own name. And, you know, I don't know what that would look like in an election, but for now, I guess I'm encouraged that someone's taken the step to form a new eco-socialist party. And it's not just happening here in British Columbia. I noticed and I've been in touch a little bit with a group in Winnipeg that is just getting started. It's called People Over Profit. And they say they're looking to run explicitly eco-socialist candidates in all the wards in the next Winnipeg municipal elections, which are coming up in 3 years. Then you have one of the candidates for the Green Party federally, or one of the potential candidates, Alex Tyrrell, who's said he's interested in running now that Elizabeth May has said she's stepping down. He identifies as an eco-socialist. And you're seeing this in other countries as well. So people from either from the NDP who see the party as not quite left enough, or from social democracy, wanting that to be more left and more green, or from within different green parties in various jurisdictions, you're seeing people break off and say, no, we should actually identify as eco-socialist, and we should try to bring the Greens and the left together. So all of that to say, you know, it's really early days in terms of the BC Eco-Socialist Party, but it's a very positive thing. We usually have a pretty conformist, our political culture is too conformist in British Columbia. For example, a lot of the energy and the dynamism we're seeing in the United States on the left is based on the fact that they have a virtuous competition. Even in a party as corrupt as the Democratic Party, they allow primaries at the congressional level. They allow primaries. You know, we're all watching. Our attention is like very much focused on the U.S. presidential primaries because it is a democratic process. They spend a year like going at each other hard and differentiating amongst, the different factions or different sort of strands of center-left politics. And I think in Canada, we lack that. The NDP doesn't have a tradition of primaries, certainly not against sitting incumbents. And even a lot of the times when a riding is open for a new candidate, the real decision about who's going to take the nomination happens behind closed doors. So we need to like sort of revive a tradition of spirited competition on the left electorally. And, you know, it doesn't, there'll always be the argument that, you know, if you run anything to the left of mainstream, wherever the mainstream Social Democrats are at, you're handing victory to the right wing. But I think that's just sort of too simplistic a way of looking at it. And right now, we don't have time to we don't have time to screw around with another generation of centrist, sort of third way, mushy social democratic politics. We really urgently need the type of policies that a party like the BC Eco Socialists is advocating for. So, as my friend Jean Swanson says, or she was fond of saying when she was running for Vancouver City Council, and she ran twice when Jean Swanson first ran. She ran twice in the last couple of years. The first time she ran, everyone thought it was a crazy long shot symbolic campaign. And what Jean would say, Jean Swanson would always say is, to get the policies that we need, we have to ask for the things that we want. In other words, you just have to actually articulate the policies, that are necessary. You can't be triangulating right out of the gate and watering down your message. So that's a long way of saying a new left-wing party is a positive development, and I personally identify as an eco-socialist as sort of the best way of summing up my politics in most cases. Sometimes I'm just socialist or democratic socialist works as well, but I think it's a valuable conception of sort of needing to bring left politics make left politics more green and make green politics more left, and ultimately build new kinds of unity so that we're stronger going forward. Anyway, I have a lot of thoughts on that. That was maybe a little unfocused, but it's a brand new party. So thanks for asking about it. And yeah.
Sounds like a ringing endorsement to me.
Yeah. Well, the thing, you know, I am an NDP member as well. So one question will be, and I was quite engaged with the federal election. I happen to have a really great candidate here locally in my riding who I think also identifies as something like an eco-socialist, you know, sort of comes out of the environmental movement, but feels like the NDP federally represents her values best. So one question a new party like the eco-socialist will have to resolve is how do they relate to people who are in the NDP or who are in the Green Party and share these values, but still want to work in their riding associations or, you know, on the various committees that they might be on. So anyway, a lot of things to be worked out, but it's good to see, it's good to see a new force emerging on the scene.
Like what you've heard on the show, consider becoming a patron and get exclusive access to early content, extras, and more. Go to patreon.com/leftbehindpodcast to subscribe today. Well, that's a wrap on episode 1. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll want to keep listening. You can follow the podcast on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, and Podcast Addict. Go to our website, leftbehindpodcast.com, for all of the details. I want to thank the BC Eco Socialists, Stuart Parker, Jeff Berner, Christo Avalis, and Derek O'Keefe for being on the show for our official podcast launch. I also want to thank our first few Patreon subscribers for your support, and all of you out there sharing the blog posts on Facebook and on Twitter leading up to the launch. Stay tuned to our Facebook and Twitter accounts for more updates on future episodes, and check out our blog for everything else in between at leftbehindpodcast.com/blog. See you all next time.